Accession number 17268, Reel 4.
In the early days of Normandy, say the first 2 weeks, we, the ordinary rank and file, had very little knowledge as to whether the invasion had really succeeded or what was going on in the other parts of the theatre, say the American zone. No knowledge whatsoever. We ourselves were kept very busy, so much so that we hardly knew what other squadrons were doing. For instance, A squadron, we know, went off to do a job with a radar station. B squadron went off somewhere else to work with one of the Scottish infantry regiments. We ourselves had another job, or various jobs, working with a Scottish regiment, clearing villages or gun posts, and generally making very little progress, but it went on day by day, and we made obviously some ground, but not as much ground as wanted in the direction of Caen. There was a film made after the war called The Longest Day. I think the longest day for us lasted somewhere around about 11 or 12 days. From the 5th of June, with loading our tanks rather, onto the LSTs during the night, and then of course sailing sometime the next day, all excitement. There had been no sleep on the 5th, certainly no sleep on the 6th of June, and from then on, after landing, with it being midsummer, the daylight being from about 4 o'clock in the morning, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, very, very short nights, we were kept occupied all the day. And if we were in forward positions, it was after dusk before we could have pulled back. And having pulled back into Liga, by that time it was a question of finding out where we could fill up with petrol and ammunition, etc., etc. Very often it was a case of walking back over several fields, coming back carrying two jerry cans of fuel, going back and then carrying another two. You and the co-driver. It was very, very tiring. By that time, you'd fill the petrol in. Time was getting on, and there was time for a little bit of food then. And we've got to be back into position before dawn, it meant we were on the move again by 3 o'clock in the morning. Out of that time, so having had time for some food, it was then also a case of taking a turn of sentry duty for half an hour and getting possibly no more than 3/4 hour sleep. And that went on for day in, day out, day in, day out. Frequently, our moves were from one sector to another was also made during the night, or very late night. For instance, in the first part, in the early days, we were due to partake in an attack in the Wistrom area, which didn't go in. But 2 days later, there was a suspected attack coming farther to the west. So the whole regiment had to up sticks and go right there out as far as we could in on the western sector, because it was feared then that there was going to be a counterattack by the Germans. We were there for several days, and it was mainly a question of a holding position. The Germans did not make a severe counterattack. One afternoon, while sitting amongst the huge cornfields in Normandy, my commander went away from the tank for an O group, so I took over in the turret, and the co-driver moved over into my driving seat. As far as I knew at the time, jetty positions were somewhere about 800 yards in front of us. There again, massive cornfield in front of us. And looking out over this cornfield at one particular stage, I saw some movement which I estimated to be about 600 yards away, and the corn being about 4 foot high, I added, just see some movement in the top of the corn. So I put the gunner onto the target and got loaded with HE. In the meantime, this movement was coming towards us, and I was just about to give the word fire when I spotted that it was a black berry that was moving, coming towards me from, as far as I knew, only the Germans in front. And then as it got slightly nearer, I could see that there were red tabs. So of course it was a case of not firing. I of course watched it very, very carefully, and eventually it was a small scout car, and in it was so I found out later that it was Lieutenant Colonel Carver, who eventually became our brigadier, and of course eventually became CIGS and Field Marshal. So it was lucky I spotted it was a blackberry with and the red tabs. Very soon after this, unfortunately, Brigadier Curry, he was killed by shell fire, and although our CO, Sandy Cameron, took over brigade for a temporary time, eventually Mike Carver, he came our brigadier. Each day we would hear that we'd lost one tank, two tanks, three tanks from A squadron, B squadron, or even our own particular squadron. We were losing tanks daily. By the end of the month, the regiment was well down in strength, and at the same time our sister regiment, the 4th CLY, had a very, very bad time at Villers Bocage and lost all their senior officers, including the colonel, taken prisoner, and most of the headquarters. So by the middle of July, both regiments were only about half strength. It was decided to amalgamate the two regiments, and so it became then the 3rd, 4th CLY. At the end of the first week in July, which was about 2 weeks prior to the amalgamation, we were involved in the push with 43 Div down by the River Odon, and amidst a very, very heavy heavy shelling, our tank, we got hit, and very, very unfortunately, our commander, the squadron leader, Bobby Gale, young, very, very young actually, MC Anbar, at the age of 24, he unfortunately got killed. The rest of the crew, we were okay, but it did mean we pulled out, and of course removed Bobby's body from the tank. So we did no more than until it was reorganised. The amalgamation of the two regiments was held on Carpaker Aerodrome, and the two regiments seemed to fit in well together eventually, although the 4th CLY, a very experienced regiment as they were, they'd been involved in the desert right the way through to North Africa, and again in Italy, and of course again on from D-Day on in Normandy. So the two sister regiments did amalgamate quite easily. There was not very much outstanding as far as I can remember from then on until Falaise, and from then on it was mainly a chase right the way through to Antwerp. Referring back to Falaise, I think of all the scenes that one had come across over the years, wherever we were, I think that was by far the worst. The carnage of men and animals was absolutely horrible. Everything was just lying around, vehicles, carts, hand carts. Absolutely terrible it was. I was saying what one can never forget. In between crossing the Seine and reaching Antwerp, there were no problems, only that of being welcomed by civilians in almost every town or village we came through, welcoming us as liberators. In Antwerp, our first job was to maintain the tanks after such a long and hard drive. And after a day's work on maintenance, it was then a job to clean ourselves up, of which we'd had very little chance during our long trek from Normandy. in the evenings we were free, and most people took advantage of being welcomed by the civilians, and myself and my crew were invited into the home of our doctor and his wife for drinks, which were very, very welcome. At this stage, I can't remember how or why, but before reaching Antwerp, I had been elevated from the driver's seat up into the turret as commander. So I was therefore able to get a different view on proceedings. After a brief rest and recuperation in Antwerp, the early part of September was spent in slogging our way forward from one canal to another canal in Belgium, until one day, somewhere in the region of Geel, my tank was hit. Fortunately, we all bailed out, although it was very quickly on fire, but none of us were hurt, and we managed to crawl along the ditches with so much stuff flying overhead. It was safer in the ditch. Unfortunately, somewhere along the line, I lost my revolver. I say crawling along the ditch somewhere. It was not missed until we were back in our headquarter tanks. I do report it to the squadron leader, and his words were, as long as you and your crew are all right, it doesn't matter about the revolver. I'd lost a tank, but also through that incident I was later to lose a stripe, in as much that while waiting for a new tank, I was back in the echelon, nothing to do, and the canteen truck was going to Antwerp, so I just had a ride with the canteen truck, only away for an hour or two, but without permission, and unfortunately I was wanted during that time. By the time I was back with the squadron, the RSM was there forward with the B echelon, and said, "Sergeant England, you consider yourself under open arrest." I duly appeared the next day in front of the captain and lost a stripe. I think this was because 2 days beforehand, or the day after we'd been hit, the squadron quartermaster came up to the tanks, and I said, "Jock, bring me a revolver up next time you come. I lost mine when we bailed out yesterday." Nearby was the second in command, and having heard the conversation, he says, "How did you lose your charge in England?" I said, "When we bailed out, so we crawled along the ditches." "Why did you lose it?" I said, "Well, didn't intend to lose it." "Where did you lose it?" "Somewhere in the ditches." And I'm afraid I was not able to satisfy him as to where, why and how, and I say I was only talking to the SQMS, and actually arms akimbo. So this officer I took one myself to say, when you're talking to an officer, it's hard in England to send to attention. And this is sort of in the field of battle. I thought that's a little bit much. I'm afraid I did turn around and say, look, I've spoken to the major, he's satisfied, so am I. And I turned my back on him and walked away. So that obviously set up something between us, which he was able to take advantage of. Okay, I was wrong, but a few days later I was demoted to corporal. He was one of the very few officers in the regiment that I did not get on with. Fortunately, he did go to take command of another of the squadrons after our own squadron leader got hit and killed there again near the canals in Belgium. Another reshuffle. I did get another tank, and everything went all right. We pushed our way down to right into various parts of Holland, and then eventually made a move when the airborne invasion of Arnhem took place. We were somewhere in the Eindhoven area. We pushed north and eventually worked our way towards Nijmegen. By that time the Americans had cleared Nijmegen Bridge, but our job was to push through towards Arnhem itself. The instruction was to get over Nijmegen Bridge as quick as we possibly could, because there were some German guns about half a mile or so down river that were firing at the bridge. And as we went over, you could see that some of the things were hitting the uprights and the structure of the bridge. We drove on, actually onto the tail then of the guards armoured, and we got to a place called Elst, which I believe is about 10 or 12 kilometres from Arnhem. At that time everything was solid. The road was completely solid with tanks, artillery, everything, but it was unfortunately we were unable to, no one was able to get off the road at all to make any sort of a sweep in any direction, and that I think was one of the major reasons why we were not able to relieve the Paddy Brigade at Arnhem. Up till the end of the year, we were either having minor problems to clear areas or sitting on canals, possibly one squadron up, two in reserve, or taking our turn, but the weather and the general road conditions were very, very bad. In fact, until even when we did move up to start in the Reichwald forest to start to clear that late January, even then the weather conditions were really, really bad. Just before Christmas, when the Americans retreated in the Ardennes, we were alerted and we're to move. I don't know where to, but the road were 2 to 3 inches thick with ice, and our tracks would not hold at all. And after just turning around and around in the road, everything was all called off. Impossible to move. Up to the Reichwald Forest, rain, and all the tracks of the forest were really deep in mud. Quite a lot went on. It was really hard going and hard fighting, and the infantry in particular, they did a damn good job clearing that. And that was, if I remember rightly, right into February. At the end of the month, we set out for a place called Udom, which was over the border in Germany. And I think this was one of the most unpleasant parts of the war we'd had for some considerable time. Ground conditions were very, very bad. Mud, water, everywhere was waterlogged. A lot of artillery fire coming from the Germans, and there was apparently a Jagdpanzer which knocked out several of our tanks, and in fact right next to the tank, my tank, was one of my very own particular pals, and he was unfortunately killed when their tank was hit. It was a really ding-dong battle all day long. Of course, with the advantage all the time on the defenders. The conditions were so bad we could not even pull back at night time to Liga. It was a case of stay where we were, covered by the infantry. And we even lost a tank to a bazooka, which was brought up during the night by one of the Jerrys. Next morning we did move forward under smoke screen, and made some progress, but there again artillery was very, very heavy, and once again we lost a colonel who received a wound from which he died. In that short period of battle we lost 3 out of the 5 field officers, the commander of the scout troop, the adjutant, and the commander of A1 Echelon, and quite a number of other troops, of course. It was from the Reichwald Forest onwards, down to Udom, where our last battle was, and then continuing on up through Cleve and Goch. The Germans, of course, were defending their homeland for the first time, and they were defending it very, very strongly. Most of the battles were very, very hard fought, lots of artillery, and there was no respite until the Germans had been pushed back to the Rhine itself. By mid-March we were very close to the Rhine, and everything was being brought forward, building up, ready for the crossing. I feel sure we lived under a smoke screen, a paraffin smelling for certainly about 2 weeks before the actual assault across the river. Everything was paraffin, whatever we ate smelled of paraffin. But it certainly created the fog which hid all the equipment that was being built up ready for the crossing.